Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts Community of Christ offers for today's world.
Welcome. This is Cup of Joe, where we explore restoration history, and I'm your host, Karen Peter. Here at Cup of Joe, we partner with the Historic Sites Foundation to interview the presenters from their lecture series. And right now, we're interviewing presenters from their spring lecture series of 2022. And our guest today is Eric Paul Rogers. And Eric is a lifetime Brighamite from, that's a term that, all you Community of Christ listeners, you just perked up when I said that, because that's not something you're used to hearing. So a lifelong Brighamite raised in California, Wyoming, Montana, and Tennessee. And his interest in the topic today grew out of his research into the Morrisite movement. And I'm looking forward to hearing a little bit more about that. The archivists from Community of Christ, Ron Romick and Barbara Bernauer, were very helpful in providing access to materials that are housed in Independence, Missouri. So we give a big thank you to them. Eric now lives in Salt Lake City, where he conducts educational research for Latter-day Saint seminaries and institutes of religion. And he's been a member of John Whitmer Historical Association, that was a tongue twister there, since 2000. And you can learn more about Eric and his professional and academic activities at his website, ericpaulrogers.com. So welcome, Eric.
Thank you very much, Karen. It's great to be with you.
I'm so glad that you are able to do our interview today, because this is a topic that I don't know a whole lot about, and I'm guessing many of our listeners don't know a whole lot about. And your contribution for this spring lecture series is titled Mark Hill Forscut, Mormon Missionary, Morrisite Apostle, RLDS Minister. So we've got a lot going on there just in the title of your lecture. So let me share the brief description that's out there so our listeners get a little bit of an idea of where we're going. In your lecture, you're going to explore three interwoven threads in the restoration movement through the experiences of, you have here in quotations, Uncle Mark, as he was known to many in the reorganization. And particular attention in your lecture is to the extinct faction of the church called the Church of the Firstborn, or the Morrisites, established by Joseph Morris. So with that, my first question is, why? Why are you doing a lecture on Mark Forscut at this juncture, at this point, for Historic Sites Foundation?
Well, it really starts with a very personal question. Many years ago, when I was dating my now ex-wife, I found that her family was very antagonistic towards Mormons. And I wanted to understand that, since I was very much interested in marrying her. And so as I talked to her about the reasons for their animosity towards the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I discovered that her ancestors had joined the church in Denmark and then emigrated to Utah, where they found things different than what they had expected. And they started looking for alternatives to the church that Brigham Young was the leader of. One of those alternatives was the church, or at least the group that Joseph Morris was leading, that you've referred to as the Church of the Firstborn, or the Morrisites. And as I'll talk about in my presentation, there was a battle that took place between the Utah Territorial Militia and the Morrisite community at South Weber, Utah. And at the beginning of that battle, the militia, which had cannon up above the fort where the Morrisites were gathered, which is now Hill Air Force Base, they shot a warning cannon over the fort as a sign that they were serious about confrontation. The second cannon that fired misfired, and the ball went into an open air Bowery outside the fort where Morris's followers were gathered. And it took the chin off of a 14-year-old girl named Mary Christofferson. Well, that is the one of the ancestors of my ex-wife.
Oh,
and
dear.
So that, Mary ended up marrying an Anderson and moving to Soda Springs, Utah. And on their headstone in the cemetery in Soda Springs is the Morrisite account of that battle. And of course, it doesn't reflect well on Brigham's Church, the church that I belong to. And so understanding that story was very significant. Now, my ex-wife's direct ancestors didn't go to Soda. Mary was an aunt, so that was Aunt Mary. Her direct ancestors ended up in Deer Lodge, Montana, and within two generations had joined the RLDS Church in Deer Lodge. And so so I became curious about the Morrisite movement. I became curious about the reorganized church or the Community of Christ. And I also was in a class at Brigham Young University with Richard Holzapfel. Dr. Holzapfel is a professor of church history and doctrine, and his wife Jenny was a descendant of Morrisites. And so all of those interests and questions and connections converged, leading me to Mark Hill Forskett, who was who played a role in each of those three restorationist factions. And I think it's just a fascinating insight into those three movements and how they interconnected and interacted with one another.
I'm delighted that your research came out of your personal experience and wanting to better understand those relationships. Before you share with us a little bit about your lecture and what you're going to talk about in your lecture, I had a couple of questions to kind of set the stage for that. And one of them was, when you began to prepare your lecture, were there really important things you wanted to make sure to include so that we can kind of watch for them as you share? And then the second is, were there any challenges that you really felt were kind of looming there as you put this together?
My research started probably 20 years ago. So one of the challenges that I faced was finding sources. I knew from publication from the Saints Herald that Mark Forskett and Betsy Forskett, his wife, Betsy Unsworth, Elizabeth Unsworth Forskett, who was known as Betsy, that their daughter Ruby, who married Lee Fonts, had published in the 1930s, a number of excerpts from Mark's journals. So I knew that he had extensive journals, but I couldn't find them. And I knew that they would be very significant to a really thorough study of Forskett. So I went to Ron Rome again. Ron told me he didn't know where they were, even though he did. So I hope he hears this because I just want to jab him a little bit. I'm quite confident that he knew exactly where they were, but he said they existed. He was confident that they were available or that they existed, but I had to do the homework. And I eventually found them in Madison, Wisconsin with a granddaughter of Ruby Forskett Fonts. And so getting at that source material was a bit of a challenge. And I am just poking fun at Ron because Ron and Barbara Bernauer were exceptionally helpful in my archival research there in Independence. But getting at a history and getting at source material for somebody like Mark was challenging to get to that original source material. Unfortunately, too, I found out as I met with Marcine Fonts Drescher, so the granddaughter of Ruby, she says, you know, I know that there's a period of time here in the journals that's missing. And she goes, I'm not sure why, but I'm pretty sure that there was some marital problems between Mark and Betsy, and that those journals were destroyed. And so I didn't know it when I published my article about Mark in 2001. I've since discovered that that there were some other issues, and I know a little bit more detail that I'll share in the presentation that I didn't know 20 years ago. What I would highlight is Mark's zeal, and on the other side of that coin is the impact of his zeal, particularly on Betsy, his wife, and on his family. Having been a minister in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I've served twice as bishop for almost 10 years. I've served as a full-time missionary in Germany for 2 years. I have been overzealous at times, much to the detriment of people that I love. And while I will highlight the zeal and the sheer quantity of work that Mark accomplished, the other side of that coin is the sheer pain and heartache that he, because of that choice, inflicted on his family. And I wish that his wife Betsy had been as prolific a diarist as Mark, because I think there's a tremendous story to be told there. And reconstructing that story from limited sources would be very difficult.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people listening who have served full-time in ministry or have served as pastors felt a little ouch there when you shared that, Eric. I know I did. So you feel a little bit about what that is like.
I have a wonderful Community of Christ friend who now lives in Arizona. His name is Don Brown. Don was a pastor of the Ogden congregation years ago, and we visit regularly and have had conversations around this. But emotional health for pastors, I think, is tremendously challenging. When you're in the zeal of serving the Lord with all your heart, might, mind, and strength, you can be blind to some of the harm that you do. And I think everybody does good and everybody does harm, and it's about mitigating that harm. And sometimes it's hard to see the harm that we're doing in the midst of trying to do our best in serving God.
Absolutely. My father says we did the best we could with what we knew at the time, and that's what we can ask for.
You know, that reminds me, on Mark and Betsy are buried at Wyuka Cemetery in Nebraska City. They passed away there in 1903, just a couple weeks apart. And below their names and dates is something to the effect of, we did the best we could. And I see there's a lot in those few words.
It's what we can ask for.
Yeah.
So let's talk a little bit about Mark Forscutt. I want to learn a little bit about him and how he ended up in three different branches of restoration religious movement. So what's important for us to know?
Well, Mark was born in Godmanchester, England, which is about 17 miles northwest of Cambridge, so in central England. He had grand plans to go to Cambridge University. And when he was about 19, he and a number of his friends decided that they would have some fun with the Mormon missionary. So he was born in 1834. So this would be in the around 1853. And as a result of having fun with the Mormon missionaries, he became converted. And so be careful who you have fun with, right? I think his conversion was deeply rooted in a testimony of the Book of Mormon and the prophet Joseph Smith. He didn't go to Cambridge. Instead, he became a missionary. And so in 1855, Orson Pratt, an apostle, called him as a missionary to serve in England. So between 1855, 2 years after his conversion, to 1860, he served essentially as a full-time missionary in a number of different areas within England, initially near his home. He served in Shipplam, in Norwich, in Preston. Eventually, he was also called to leadership roles. He served as the president of the Preston Conference, of the Wiltshire Conference down in the South, and also wrote for the Millennial Star, which was the Latter-day Saint newspaper in England at the time. So from the very beginning, he was deeply engaged in ministry and was very successful. He's known as a very gifted orator and teacher of the gospel, and he was extremely diligent. He kept very good records, and I think he records traveling something like 10,562 and a half miles during his ministry before his emigration to the United States in 1860.
That's a lot of miles in England.
That is a lot of miles in England.
Absolutely.
So, of course, for most of the Latter-day Saint converts in England, the desire was to emigrate to Zion. And so in 1860, just 2 days before leaving on a ship called the Underwriter from Liverpool, Mark married Elizabeth Unsworth in Bolton. And then 2 days later, they were on the Underwriter with a group of over 500 saints, about 90 of which were from Switzerland, and the rest from the UK. And they had about a 30-day crossing aboard the Underwriter. Mark notes in his diaries, I believe there were five deaths and five marriages, or four deaths and four marriages, something like that. Interestingly, Mark was a gifted musician, and he loved to sing, and he sang at the wedding on board ship during the Atlantic crossing, the marriage of Johann Lebrecht Baer, who was a Swiss convert to Mormonism, and he would go by John Baer later, and they would eventually, once part of the reorganization, would work together in the ministry. So not yet Morrisite, not yet Reorganite or Josephite, but becoming friends on that transatlantic voyage.
I can't say much for his choice of honeymoon for Betsy. That couldn't have been a big
absolutely clue. Not. And Karen, you're hitting on a theme that I've already hinted at, I guess. And that is, I feel for Betsy. I feel for her deeply. And I don't think Mark really grasped or understood the impact on her. So yes, not a great honeymoon choice.
All right. So they head to Utah.
Yeah. So they disembark at New York and then begin their overland travels. They end up at Florence, Nebraska, and it's there that they join the Daniel Robison Handcart Company, and with some 40, I think 40 handcarts and 10 wagons, and with the Robison Company, they make their way from Florence, Nebraska to the Great Salt Lake City. When they arrive, Mark is immediately put into a position of responsibility. He's made a secretary to Brigham Young. He's called as a president of the 70. So he shares that with you, as I understand.
Yes.
I think it was the 62nd quorum of 70 that he was called to preside over, and called by Joseph Young, one of Brigham's brothers. And so that's, let's see. So we're into the spring, early summer of 1860 that Mark begins to take on these responsibilities. But with those responsibilities come pressure to enter into plural marriage. And Mark and Betsy are not having any of that. And so between June of 1860 and August of 1860, there's a transition, a breakaway from Brigham. And they align themselves with Joseph Morris, who now has fairly significant following at a place called South Weber, Utah. As a matter of fact, before I moved to Salt Lake 2.5 years ago, I lived in South Weber. And there was a fort in South Weber that was named after a former Latter-day Saint bishop named Kington. So the fort was called Kington Fort. It was built in the 1850s, but when Johnston's army, the Federal Army, was sent to put down the Mormon Rebellion in 56 and 57, and most of the Latter-day Saints moved south to avoid conflict with the U.S. Army, and so the fort was abandoned at that time. So by 1860-61, that the Morrisites begin to occupy the fort, and that becomes their central base. And there are probably 500 followers at the peak of Morris. There's only maybe 150 members of the South Weber ward of the Brighamite Church. And Morris converts the bishop, Richard Cook, and 16 others of his congregation. And so two of the Mormon apostles, John Taylor and Wilford Woodruff, go to South Weber, excommunicate the bishop and those other congregants that align themselves with Morris. And the conflict between the Brighamite neighbors and the Morrisites begins to grow.
Well, I can see some repetition in a reversed role there of being outnumbered by your neighbors.
Yes.
What happened in some other places. I mean, we're getting some reminiscence of Independence and Nauvoo and some other.
Exactly. And in the same way that the early Latter-day Saints didn't treat their native Missourian neighbors particularly well and contributed to the conflict, the Morrisites did a number of things that were threatening to their Mormon neighbors. Mm-hmm. And I say Mormon, I mean, that they're all Mormon, right? So I'll use Brighamite and Morrisite and maybe Josephite in the as we move forward to distinguish allegiance to a particular leader. But Mark and Betsy end up with that community of Morrisites in South Weber at Kington Fort. And on April 1st, 1861, the church is formally organized. So Morris, prior to this, believed that he should be the spiritual leader of the church and Brigham Young should be the temporal leader of the church, that was Brigham's strength, spiritual leadership was Morris's strength. He wrote a series of letters to Brigham Young to that effect. There are, in the archives here in Salt Lake, those letters exist with some marginal notes, with things like balderdash and nonsense and so forth. So I think Brigham Young and the church leadership kind of wrote Morris off as kind of an annoying gnat, but not much of a threat. However, by 1861, he's got quite a following. And now he's converted the local bishop and a number of his congregation. So, and then he formally organizes his own church, which became known as the Church of the Firstborn or the Morrisite Church.
How long did that strand of Mormonism last?
So in various forms, and under various leaders, it survived into the 20th century. The last manifestation survived into the 1950s at a place called Racetrack near Deer Lodge, Montana. And there's still a building where the Morrisite movement or Church of the Firstborn gathered at racetrack. And so if you drive Interstate, is that Interstate 90 through there, when you're just east of, you're west of Anaconda and east of Deer Lodge, you can see it at the Deer Lodge, at the racetrack exit on the south side of the interstate. And I'll be showing a picture of that building in my presentation in April.
Excellent. I've been to Deer Lodge several times and I wish I had known this then because this is fascinating.
Yeah, and Deer Lodge is another fascinating place. So in the same way that I'm interested in Mark because of his connection to all three restoration movements, Deer Lodge is the last place I know of where you had a standing Morrisite or Church of Firstborn community, an RLDS community, and a Latter-day Saint ward. And so I think there's a lot to be learned there. I've been in the Community of Christ building in Deer Lodge and met a number of folks there. And so that's another interest that I have that maybe when I retire early, like you're retiring early, I'll pursue that in a little more detail.
Well, it's fascinating because if you've been to Deer Lodge, there's not much there except the old territorial prison, and it's right outside a national site called the Grant Corps Ranch. But
yes,
you wouldn't think that it would have a significance theologically or in the restoration tradition's historical narrative in Deer Lodge. That just is not what would come to mind.
I'll just throw in a quick tangent too. There was a religious leader that was imprisoned at Deer Lodge in the 1970s who picked up on some of Morris's and Morris's successors' revelations and believed, he and his followers in the 1970s, 1980s, believed that the location of the Second Coming was not Adam on Diamond, and not Independence, but actually the prison at Deer Lodge, Montana.
Okay, that is, that's one of those fun, weird facts that is gonna harbor itself in my brain forever now. Deer Lodge, Montana. Okay, you folks are listening.
For those that want to explore that idea, a friend of mine, acquaintance of mine named Roy Anderson, who is a professor of sociology at the University of Montana, who's written most extensively about Joseph Morris, in his third edition of his book, Joseph Morris and the Saga of the Morrisites, he writes about that group that I was just mentioning. So he does that in much more detail.
Oh, that's fascinating. Thank you. All right. So Forskett comes over to the U.S., goes to Utah, becomes disenfranchised, joins the Morrisites. And now we're in South Weber.
That's right.
What happens from there?
So Morris predicts the imminent coming of Jesus Christ, and he names the date, which we should know from long experience is never a good idea. Yep. However, he names the date New Year's Day, 1862. Well, because Jesus is coming, guess what the Morrisites don't do during the summer of 1861? They don't plant crops. They don't, they're expecting Jesus to return. And so they are very ill prepared and suffer tremendously from hunger and hardship through the winter of 1861, 1862, and from a tremendous disappointment when Jesus does not appear. Morris picks a new date, as is customary for many religious leaders, blames the people for the failure of the Lord to come. And they're being harassed by their Brighamite neighbors. Just to give you an anecdote, there's an account of neighbors riding their horses into the fort and into the homes that are built on the periphery of the fort, taking the hat off one of the men. And when the man retrieves his hat, then going to the local sheriff, who was Lot Smith, and filing a claim of thievery against the Morrisites. And so they were constantly dealing with these kinds of things. They also refused or were resistant to participating in military exercises that the Morrisites were in. So they were harassed for their failure to participate. There was just a tremendous deal of conflict. And then the hunger, the hardship of the winter created a lot of turmoil. Three of Morris's followers, let me back up just a second. When you joined the Morrisite community, you consecrated all of your property to the community. So when three of Morrisite's followers kind of had enough, they decided to leave. Well, they took their things, their property, and left. And when Morris discovered this, he organized a posse and went to reclaim the stolen property and to bring those three individuals back to the fort where they were imprisoned. When family members of these individuals got wind of this, they went to the governor and sought redress. So the governor ordered the territorial militia to go enforce the release, enforce a writ of habeas corpus and the release of these three individuals. Well, as the territorial the territorial marshal was out of the territory, so the deputy territorial marshal led that militia up to South Weber from Salt Lake. Well, they gained in number as they passed through the various communities on their way through Davis County up to the north end of Davis County. They set up their camp on the north on the South Bluffs. Spectators gathered on the South Ogden side of those bluffs because they're down in a valley at the mouth of Weber Canyon along the side of the Weber River where the fort's located. So they're out there to spectate from the north side of the valley, the militias on the south side of the valley, and a three-day battle ensues that I've already alluded to that ultimately takes the lives of Joseph Morris, a number of his followers, and a number of the militia. There's a lot of detail behind that I will skip, but a three-day battle, and the Morrisites are brought up on charges, much to the chagrin of the Brighamites. The non-Mormon judge dismisses, and the Morrisites scatter. There's a diaspora of Morrisites, primarily to Carson City, Nevada, to Soda Springs, Idaho, and to Deer Lodge, Montana. However, Mark and Betsy join none of those groups. They remain in Salt Lake. And Mark joins the California Volunteers at Fort Douglas, which is the U.S. Army base on the bench overlooking the Salt Lake Valley. To make sure that the Mormons don't get out of line.
Some deeply held animosity at this point.
That's right.
Yes. Yeah, that's especially right. To join the federal troops after the history of some of the Mormon wars.
Exactly.
All right. So the Morrisites have scattered. Mark and Betsy are still there. What happens to introduce the reorganization into his experience?
Well, as you can imagine, Betsy was not happy with any religion at this point. As a matter of fact, she tells Mark, "Don't bring me religion again." I failed to mention in that very, very busy month of June 1861, Betsy gave birth to their first child, a daughter named Elizabeth Amy. She went by Amy. So during that battle, it's not just Betsy and Mark that survive, but a little child who's just a year old. And so Mark avoids religion. And as part of his assignment with the California Volunteers, this is 1862. And so they believed that they were going to be sent east to fight in the Civil War. However, instead of being sent east, they were sent to Ruby Valley, Nevada, to protect the Overland Route to California. And so the three of them moved and all lived out at Fort Ruby in the wilderness of Nevada as part of Mark's military assignment. By 1864, they returned to Salt Lake. And guess who Mark meets in December? But Josephite missionaries. And he doesn't tell Betsy, but he meets them at the beginning of December and he gets baptized on January 1, 1865. And he's baptized and confirmed. And within a couple of months, he is in the Utah District Presidency. He's in charge of publication. He's given a number of responsibilities and eventually has to come clean with Betsy. So now, not only is he a former Morrisite, but he's a Josephite running a restaurant or trying to run a restaurant in Salt Lake City, which, as you can imagine, was not easy.
This would be a period of time when the reorganization routinely sent missionaries out to Utah to try to regain members or to convince members to leave what we now understand as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and come back to what's known now as Community of Christ, but at that time, the reorganization. So this was an active back and forth between the Midwest and Utah.
That's right. I think most of us Brighamites grew up thinking that everybody just came west, right? There wasn't an awareness when I was a kid that there were such things as the Community of Christ or the Reorganized Church, or that there was such thing as the Strangite Church. My good friend Bill Shepherd, and I have a number of friends that are in Wisconsin who are Strangites, or John Hayacek, or Cutlerites, or what the relationship was between the Cutlerites and the Josephites, right? The interactions and attempts to convert one another back and forth between those groups. That's been something that's come to my awareness as I've done this research. Yeah. So we're pretty arrogant, the Brighamite lot. We think we're the big ones and really the only ones. Well, I've learned that's not the case. And I have to admit, in terms of my beliefs and my preferences, I'm probably a closeted Josephite, to be honest.
I have not heard that term before. That's fun.
I do want to make a connection though. And I don't know if this is due to, if this is in retrospect or if this was in real time, but when Mark and Betsy were in Florence before they got to Utah, they met a couple that they had known in England that had come back from Salt Lake, who pled with them not to go to Utah. And Betsy said, you know, the die was cast and we happily went on our way. It became pretty clear later that maybe they should have listened to Mr. and Mrs. Holt, who they had met in Florence before they went to Utah.
All along that Mormon trail, you would encounter people who had left to come back or people that had not gone and were trying to convince others to not go. Yeah,
exactly. I think the estimates are put at some one third actually returned to the Midwest or to the East after emigrating to Utah. So again, that's not part of the Utah Mormon consciousness, but it's a reality that many in the reorganization were aware of because their ancestors were some of those.
Right, right.
Including John Bear, right, whose wedding.
Yeah, let's go back to John Bear. How do we pick him up again? So Forescott has now become active and a leader in the reorganization. Is he still in Utah? And where does John Bear come in?
So not until after Mark heads back to the Midwest. So okay. let me pick that up. So there's a note left on Mark's door that says, if you don't leave the territory, you will die the death of an apostate dog.
Ouch.
So that's what Mark reports anyway, right? And that's not unusual. There are numerous accounts of threats, if not actual violent action against non-Mormons or apostates in Utah territory at that time. The Mormon Reformation under Brigham Young, George A. Smith, Jedediah Grant, there was very violent rhetoric in the direction of apostates and non-Mormons, which certainly led to circumstances which made the Mountain Meadows Massacre possible, in which men, women, and children were slaughtered by Latter-day Saints in southern Utah. That was fresh on the minds of non-Mormons and apostates when Mark was in Salt Lake in 1865, 1866.
Okay. So Mark, less than a decade later.
That's right. So that would have been very close. Mark says that Betsy encouraged him to leave to protect his life. I wonder if that's more Mark than Betsy. But he leaves without her and without Amy and without Lulu Sarah, who was born in Ruby Valley. So he leaves Betsy and his two daughters and heads east as quickly as he can. So that's in 1866. In August, before he gets to Plano, he writes to Joseph III telling him he's on his way and he had to get out of town right away. He says, two days after I left, Dr. Robinson, my neighbor, was murdered by the Mormons, by the Danite fraternity is the language that he uses. So certainly what the stories that Mark has to tell paints Utah Mormonism in a very negative light, most of which is certainly deserved. And it's not just Mark's voice, it's others that have had similar experiences. But Mark, I think, was one of the real contributors to the perspective that the Midwestern Saints had on the Utah Church.
So, and his perspective was colored by his experience in the Morrisites as well.
Yes,
heavily colored by that. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
So by the fall of 1866, I think September or November, he's in Plano with Joseph. And Joseph immediately puts him to work. And here you've got a skilled writer, a skilled speaker, a skilled preacher, somebody who's had great success as a missionary, who has musical talents. I mean, Mark is a catch. I don't think Betsy would have agreed at the time, but he was definitely a catch.
Now, she's still in Utah at this point?
She's still in Utah. And what I didn't know when I published my paper in the John Whitmer Journal in 2001 was that she did divorce him.
Ah.
So I haven't found the divorce records, but I'm on the trail of that. And what I do find is when Betsy and Amy and Lulu Sarah eventually come to the Midwest. They meet Mark in St. Louis in 1868. So he's been gone for 2 years. And I have a letter that he wrote to a friend, a mutual friend. And he says, she won't write me. She doesn't want to live with me. And I'm like, dude, yeah. Do you wonder why? And I think I could have said that to him and he would have said, no, I don't understand why, because he still saw her salvation as dependent upon him.
Yes. So, and yet she had told him, don't bring me religion
again. So he had blind spots like I've had and I'm sure I still do have in many aspects of my life, but it's so obvious to me. And I think it must've been obvious to Joseph, but the third, but I don't think Mark was hearing it. So yes, Mark is very busy before Betsy comes and becomes just as busy or more busy after she comes. But I found their marriage certificate in St. Louis on Christmas Day, 1868. So he goes from thinking that she doesn't want to live with him, wants to have nothing to do with him. They make it there to St. Louis, connect. They're married on Christmas Day, 1868. And Lulu, Sarah, and Amy are blessed in the reorganization 2 days later. And get this. Oh, Karen, this is so painful. because I'm an ally of Mark, but he just drives me crazy. While he's blessing Lulu Sarah, guess what? He changes her name.
Oh, God.
To Ruby Celeste.
Oh.
To which he records in his diary. He goes, Betsy was somewhat indignant. Until I explained to her that I was moved upon by the Spirit to change her name.
So
I hope I'm a fan of Mark's, but I hope I can give a little bit of a balanced view. And I hope I give a very sympathetic view of Betsy. To me, she's the hero in all of this, to be honest.
We did some interviews here at Project Zion, a Cup of Joe, on the three successive wives of Joseph Smith III and what those relationships were like. And he was every bit as busy, traveled every bit as much, but had the completely opposite experience because he tended the relationship even in the midst of all of the busyness of administrating the church. So as you're talking about poor Mark Forskett, I'm comparing that to what I've learned about how Joseph Smith III was with his family and thinking, oh, Mark, you should have paid attention.
So I'm glad you said that because I felt the same way. And I can't find it. I hope somebody that's listening can find evidence of this. But I just see Joseph going, Mark, you're not seeing this. Now, Emmeline Griswold passes away in 1869 in Lamoni, or in Plano. Well, where does, and Joseph is devastated. He's so devastated, he moves in with Mark and Betsy and the girls.
Oh, gosh.
So they are very close. I think Uncle Mark comes from his relationship with Joseph, right?
Yeah.
And then everybody in the church takes on that. But Joseph moves in with Mark and Betsy and now Amy and Ruby, not Lulu. And they help him through that very devastating part of his life.
Yeah.
A very tragic time.
It's been interesting to compare not just Joseph Smith III and Mark Forskett, but Joseph Smith III and his father, because now we're getting something that's more akin to what Mark Forskett was experiencing.
Yes.
So we can have similar kind of, oh my God, feelings about Emma as well, which I have on a regular basis. All right. So let's get back. How does he reconnect with John Bear?
So I don't have the details, but I know that in his, he kind of at first, Joseph gave him this responsibility to basically, he was a troubleshooter for Joseph. And so where there were doctrinal issues, where there were leadership issues, or where there were conflicts among congregants, Mark would go and deal with those issues. And it was in those missionary labors and in those administrative assignments that he reconnected with John Bear. Now, can I share a little bit of a tangent?
Sure.
I was in Independence at the temple visiting and doing research. And I decided to take, I had my family with me and I wanted them to see Carthage Jail. So we took them to Carthage Jail. And so all of this Forskett research is on my mind. When we walk in the door in Liberty, Missouri, in the Latter-day Saint Visitor Center there, and there are two senior missionaries, two older missionaries with their name tags on. And I look at the name tag, and guess what the name tag is on the man? It's Elder Bear. And I'm like, you wouldn't happen to be related to Johann Lebrecht Bear from Switzerland? He goes, oh yeah, he's my great-great-grandfather. Yeah, I was raised in the Community of Christ in our LDS Church in Arizona, and then converted to the LDS Church. So anyway.
So they're still back and forth.
Still back and forth to this day, right? And some of my best friends in the Community of Christ are former Brighamites like me. So anyway, yeah.
And some of us are split. My grandmother was a Brighamite and all her people. And so, my father became part of the reorganization. Okay. So, poor Betsy, and they're heavily involved in the reorganization How does his life culminate? What happens to him?
So he continues in his service. Even before Betsy comes in 1866 and 1867, he's working with Marietta Walker on the inspired version of the Bible, on copying and editing the manuscript there. And so very much engaged in the work. I guess I could hit some highlights. By the way, I don't want to miss this. I wanted to share. So before Alexander and David and Joseph come, after the railroad is in place to Salt Lake City, mm-hmm. Alexander had been there previously, right? As a matter of fact, so it was Mark and Betsy's home in Salt Lake. It was the third home that Alexander entered. And I wanted to share with you just a quote from Alexander. He wrote back to Joseph and he said, and so this is August of 1866. This is right before Mark leaves to join Joseph in Plano. And Alexander says, "Brother Mark is a diamond of the first water, keen, shrewd, and intelligent, one of God's zealous and fearless servants, fearless, energetic, active, and capable. He works for the Lord." And I hope you see how that aligns with the depiction that I've tried to paint of Mark. What Alexander doesn't say is there's the other side of the coin.
Yes, there. And Betsy thinks this sucks and would wish he would stop.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
In addition to his work with Marietta on the inspired version of the scriptures, he is editing the Zion's Hope, which is the Sunday mm-hmm. school newspaper. And he is editing the True Latter-day Saints Herald, which was the early title, right, of the Saints Herald. Now, I believe Joseph III is the official editor, but Marietta and Mark are the ones that are doing the heavy lifting with that work. So very influential, but he's got so much experience writing. I mentioned his inviting Joseph III into the home when Emmeline Griswold passes. And so he's very close to Joseph. And he's also given us an assignment to compile a hymnal. And so the Saint's Harp, which was published in 1870, was edited primarily by Mark. It has Joseph III's name on it, but Mark does so much of the work. And 88 of the selections in that hymnal contain poetic verse by Mark Forescutt. In 1871, so just a year later after the publication of the Saint's Harp, Mark is instructed to compile a second hymnal. Now, there are 20 years of organizational changes, committee changes, and obstacles. So that publication doesn't actually see the light of day until 1889. And it's published as the Saint's Harmony. And I actually have I know this is audio only, but I do have a reprinted version of the Saint's Harmony. And I love it because it has this split format with the music on the upper half of the page and then the words on the lower half of the page, so you can match the words to the music. And Mark actually has a whole biographical sketch at the end of that book. So very much involved in the publishing, writing, editing, publishing of both newspapers and music for the reorganization.
So I'm looking as you're speaking, because I see in our current hymnal, the newest hymnal in Community of Christ, we have three.
That's right. Only three remain.
Mm-hmm. The Let Us Pray for One Another. I'm looking at what the others are, because now you've got me curious.
I don't know how.
Go now forth into sung. The world. That's one that every Community of Christ person has sung many times in their life. And finally, Take my gifts and let me love you. That one is not as familiar to me, but the other two, oh my goodness, yes.
Yeah. Foundational. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So in the early 1870s, Mark is appointed as General Church Secretary. In 1872, though, guess what? He gets released to go on a mission. And to go on a mission where? To England. And who does he take? Not Betsy.
Not Betsy.
He takes Amy. He does say, I felt badly, very badly at the station where leaving my wife, she, dear soul, seemed brokenhearted. Yeah.
I'm wondering about that, to be honest.
He says,
I don't know how brokenhearted I'm going to be at that point.
God bless and comfort her. Father above, I leave my loved one to preach the gospel of thy son. Oh, be thou her, their stay, comforter and helper. So the lip service was there. The action was not.
Yeah. Although let's give him the benefit of the time.
That's right. He is a product of his time.
Yeah.
But as you've pointed out, there were other ministers who did attend to their family responsibilities
yeah.
in ways that maybe yeah. Mark did not.
Didn't. That wasn't in his makeup.
Yeah.
So, and how long did he live? How long did Mark Forskett live?
Until 1903.
Okay.
Long so he plays a role in the Kirtland Temple lawsuit. He and Joseph III have quit claim deeds to the Kirtland Temple. And so when E.L. Kelly brings a lawsuit to clear title to the Kirtland Temple, he is involved in that. He's involved in the doctrinal dispute that ultimately leads Jason Briggs and Zenas Gurley to withdraw their membership from the church. He serves another mission in the 90s to the Society Islands, to Tahiti. On his way back in San Francisco, he dedicates the gospel ship, a ship that is bought to support the saints in Tahiti. That's called the Evangelia, and actually composes a hymn for that dedicatory, the dedication of that ship. Eventually, in 1889, no, 18 in late 1890s, 1898, he oversees the branch of the church in Nebraska City, and it's there that he that Betsy actually passes away on October 5th, 1903. Mark, they had been planning to move to California. Mark had suffered illness throughout his ministry. And Betsy passes away. So Mark continued his preparations to go to California, but passes away just 2 weeks later on October 18th. And they're buried at Wyuka Cemetery in Nebraska City. Joseph III spoke at his funeral. And of course, they were close. They had an agreement that whoever passed away first, the other would officiate at their funeral. Mark also spoke, gave the funeral sermon at Emma Hale Smith Biteman's funeral in 1879. So a remarkable ministerial career, tremendously zealous, as Alexander pointed out, fraught with personal challenges in his family, but very much revered as Uncle Mark by the members of the reorganization, and passed down a very venerable heritage to his children and grandchildren. There's one branch of the family that ended up in Utah and in the Latter-day Saint tradition, and I was able to connect with them at one point in my research. The individual who I connected with has now passed away. Mark's descendants who had his journals left the reorganization and ended up within the Methodist tradition. That's Marcine Fonts Drescher and her husband, Bill. So I don't know how many of his descendants are still in the reorganization.
But his life and ministry contributed to many things that the Community of Christ holds dear, and
absolutely is
actively a part of the story.
Yes.
So you've talked about some of the things that you learned since you wrote your paper in 2001, but I wanted to ask you a couple of things about how this has affected you. So what about his life as you researched him is affecting you personally as you think about your own discipleship and your own ministry?
That's a great question. I'm inspired by Mark's perseverance through hardship and adversity, and especially when that hardship and adversity comes from co-religionists. And I said I'm a closeted Josephite. You know, there are a lot of things that I love about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and a lot of things that I don't. And I think that was true of Mark in each of those three manifestations of Mormonism. Mm-hmm. And so I find a strength and an example in being an advocate for what I believe in to the degree that I can. I think Mark was very deferential, particularly to Joseph III. And he respected the office that he occupied. He respected him as a man. And I see in that an example that while I may disagree with some of the positions that my church leaders take, I can still respect the office and contribute and provide to some degree, I wouldn't maybe use this term, but to be something of a differing vision or an alternative voice to maybe a majority opinion that can actually benefit the organization without tearing it down.
Okay. And on the other side of that, what do you see as part of Mark's contribution to the ongoing DNA of Community of Christ? How is he still present with us as we journey on in Community of Christ from your perspective?
Well, I love that while diminished, I love to see that his music is still there. One of the, Joseph III said that one of the things that he admired so much about Mark was his ability to teach restoration doctrine in verse and in music. And I see it warms my heart to know that at least two of those three hymns are well known and in the hearts and minds of the Community of Christ today. I love that. His work on the inspired version, that work remains. There are many aspects of the RLDS Church that have shifted and changed over time with the Community of Christ, which I see as very positive, that are departures from what Mark would have taught. But in my mind, I see, you know, if he were alive, you know, I see him embracing Section 156, for example. I could be wrong about that, but I would hope that he would.
I'm thinking Betsy would at this point.
I know Betsy would. I know she would see that very positively. So his openness, his willingness to embrace new ideas, although I think to a large degree, you know, the RLDS Church had to offer resonated very much with what he had heard as a young man in 1853 in England. It was much more familiar to him than what he heard when he arrived in Utah. So I would hope for an openness, but I see just a wonderful minister, dedicated, committed, eloquent. I wish I were, you know, half as eloquent as he was, and just dedicated to the Lord. No matter what the Lord wanted of him at the time, he was willing to give his very best to it. And I want to give my very best to the Lord as well.
I want to thank you very much for being our guest today here at Cup of Joe. I want to give you an opportunity before we close this episode. Are there any last thoughts that you want to make sure you include before we finish for today?
I just want to express love and gratitude to my brothers and sisters in Community of Christ who have not only facilitated my research, but who have really been genuine and authentic friends to me. My research is interesting and valuable to me, but what really is long lasting are those personal relationships where I've been loved and supported and edified. And I just want to say thank you for that.
Well, thank you for sharing that and for being our guest. So for our listeners, we've been visiting with Dr. Eric Paul Rogers, and you can see his lecture at historicsitesfoundation.org. And his lecture is called Mark Hill Forskett, Mormon Missionary, Morrisite Apostle, RLDS Minister. And after listening to you, Eric, for this little bit and sharing about him, it makes way more sense than it did when we first started out. So thank
Good,
you.
Good, I'm glad.
Thank you so much for that. And to our You're listeners, this has been Cup of Joe, part of Project Zion Podcast. I'm Karen Peter, and thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to Project Zion Podcast. Subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcast, Stitcher, or whatever podcast streaming service you use. And while you are there, give us a 5-star rating. Project Zion Podcast is sponsored by Latter-day Seeker Ministries of Community of Christ. The views and opinions expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of Latter-day Seeker Ministries or Community of Christ. The music has been graciously provided by Dave Hines.